tweet at Today SOR.
I'm joined now in studio by Chris Patten, former chairman of the British Conservative Party, former senior British cabinet minister, also a member of the European Commissioner, of the Commission, I should say, the last British governor of Hong Kong. He also chaired the Independent Commission on Policing in Northern Ireland, set up under the Good Friday Agreement. He's a former chair of the BBC and current chancellor of Oxford University. Chris Patten, you're very welcome to studio. Now, despite your extensive experience in British politics, I gather that you regard the current period in British politics, the Brexit era, as the most depressing period of your life, and it goes beyond politics. Why are you saying that?
Well, partly because I think the decision to leave the European Union was a spectacular example of self-harm, totally unnecessary. The result, I think, of a number of things, including some delusions spread by politicians and a certain amount of mendacity. But I also think that it's been depressing because you look around the world and you see increasingly countries having to choose, as it were, between Trump and China, which isn't much of a choice. And I also think that the quality, the civility of public debate and public discussion has been affected in the last few years. It's a point I was trying to make in the lecture I gave last night, in partly in memory of Peter Sutherland, but a speech about the perils, the menaces to liberal democracy, which I feel rather strongly about.
And yet, Boris Johnson, who is at the receiving end of a lot of criticism, indeed not least from yourself, he got that great big thumping majority of 80 seats in the House of Commons for the programme that he set out.
He did indeed, and I should think every night he, if he prays when he goes to bed, he says his thank yous for Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, it was a disastrous Labour leadership, and he was able to make people think that the most important issue in British politics was to, quote him, to get Brexit done. The fact is that Brexit hasn't been done and won't be done for a long time as we deal with the consequences. And we're now, of course, about to embark on trade negotiations with the European Union, which will, I think, expose some of the inadequacies and nonsense about a policy which seeks to have our cake and eat it.
Yes, that's the policy that he...
Cakeism.
He says he likes to pursue. And there's a lot of concern expressed, not least by our own tarnished Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Simon Coveney, and indeed by Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, as recently as yesterday, that Britain seems to, or Boris Johnson and his team and his cabinet, who are now all staunch Brexiteers, are seeming to resile from what they agreed in the declaration about, but particularly there being no hard border on the island of Ireland. And they say there will be completely unfettered access of goods travelling east to west, in other words, coming from mainland Britain to Northern Ireland.
Well, if you take a religious analogy, it may be appropriate given the sort of dogmatic passion that they have about Brexit. They seem to me to be trying to apply consubstantiality to politics. They're saying that Northern Ireland will be both in the customs union and outside the customs union. You're either one or the other. And what Boris signed up to was a deal which actually Theresa May had said she couldn't sign up to, in which there's a border somewhere off Holyhead. So it should be under the deal which Mr. Johnson signed. It should be easier to deal with goods north-south, goods, maybe not services, rather than east-west, which has pretty profound implications for Northern Ireland. Now, what Mr. Johnson has done is to change the very good Secretary of State for Northern Ireland and to change the Attorney General, because they were absolutely clear about the obligations which we'd taken on and about the consequences of those agreements for people in Northern Ireland. So just changing people, getting rid of them, sacking them, doesn't make any difference to the reality.
But Mr. Barnier was saying yesterday, we will not conclude an agreement at any price. And he was quite animated, thumping the table and so forth. He says the trade agreement will be associated with a fisheries agreement and an agreement about a level playing field. Otherwise, there won't be any agreement at all. And presumably, the Irish Protocol will be central to whatever is discussed. I mean, that can't be gone back on as far as the European Union is concerned.
No, it can't. You can't reach agreements and then renege from them. The consequences for any future attempt to reach a trade agreement with anybody else is obvious. People point to the fact that you've already broken your word to the European Union, why would anybody else reach a trade agreement with us?
But is this all just part of kind of the limbering up that
but
goes on?
You never know with Mr. Johnson. I strongly suspect that, as happened with the deal he did, which included the border down the Irish Sea, which he denied to the DUP at conference he would ever accept, I strongly suspect that towards the end of next year we'll hear the grinding of gears as the car goes into reverse, if we want a deal at all. Recently, Mr. Johnson has, I think, said sovereignty is more important to us than having a trade deal with the European Union, that if we have to suffer with less trade in order to recover our sovereignty, then so be it. But what is this sovereignty that we're recovering? Because in the modern world, we know whether we're talking about epidemic disease.
Well, it's getting disease, out under the European Union rules and regulations, the Court of Justice,
getting out of those rules and accepting regulations elsewhere, because trade with everybody is about having a level playing field if you reach an agreement with them. If you want to do more trade, you think about something on which at least the last Secretary of State for the Environment, she's been got rid of now, who was previously in Northern Ireland, Theresa Villiers, said. She said, well, of course we'd never allow chlorinated chicken to come into the United Kingdom. We'd accept the European regulations on agri-foods. Well, if you're saying that to Americans, what you're saying to them is, we're insisting on a level playing field. If you want to sell your wretched chickens to us, you'll have to accept our rules. Relationship between Canada and Mexico and the United States, dominated by President Trump, is all about a level playing field. Level as far as the Americans are concerned. So to say that you're against level playing fields is like saying you're against any trade deal with anybody.
You previously said that Boris Johnson, this was before he became party leader and prime minister, has lied his way through life. He's lied his way through politics. He's a huckster with a degree of charm to which I am immune. In the period since he became Prime Minister, after you said that, do you see any reason to revise that view?
Well, I see some reason for being more charitable in my assessments of everybody, whether it's Boris Johnson or not. And sometimes I was thinking about this because St. Matthew's Gospel last Sunday was all about turning the other cheek and being nice to people, and perhaps I should bite my tongue sometime. But no, I mean, if I have to consider Mr. Johnson, I think I would rely very much on the people who've worked with him. I'd think about what his former editor Max Hastings said about him. I'd think about that extraordinary interview he once did with Eddie Mayer on the Sunday morning programme on the BBC, and I'd settle for what they said. So perhaps right, I shouldn't talk any more about Mr. Johnson.
One of the things, and this will be of interest obviously to you in your role as Chancellor of Oxford University, there had been concern that there would be a serious diminution of resources from Europe for scientific and other research at academic level, that academics wouldn't want to come to work in Britain, or they might feel, even if they're there, they'd have to leave. Boris Johnson talks about, I think, turning Britain now into one of the best places to do science in the world, and they're going to put much more emphasis on it. I mean, what is your assessment of that particular, of that issue, the impact of Brexit on academic and scientific work?
Well, it's a subject about which I know a bit because I chaired the committee which established the European Research Council after I'd been a European Commissioner. And it's true that British higher education is very high powered, despite the fact that we don't get as much money as some others. We do very well out of European grants. We get more money back from Europe than we put in. And above all, we have very, very, very valuable collaboration projects with Europeans. Now, recognizing what we're in danger of losing, the present government have said, and this is said to be a point which Mr. Cummings, who really seems to run the government, is very keen on, that we want to establish something like the American Advanced Research Program, ARPA it's called, and attract more money into extremely significant scientific projects. If that's going to happen, fine, and we've got lots of work at Oxford, which could benefit from that sort of sustained support. But we'll have to see it. Seeing is very much relevant to believing. And what is terribly important, in addition to the money, is the collaboration between individuals and between institutions. We're trying to do quite a bit, for example, with other European institutions in the Berlin universities, Paris as well, and I hope that will make up at least something for what we're losing.
But what about the fears of a brain drain?
Well, that undoubtedly exists. Indeed, we've lost some people, not many, thank God, but we've lost one of our best economists. We've lost one of our best Catholic theologians. Both those cases were to some extent related to Brexit, not entirely, but to some extent. We've lost one or two others as well. But it's very important for us because we're a world university educating the world and having professors and academics from all over the world. It's very important that we should be able to go on attracting people. The other day when I was in Germany giving a lecture, one of the German academics said to me afterwards, you're a great university. I mean, it's extraordinary that you've got, for example, the man who's written the best biography of Luther and of the German Reformation, an Englishman. And I said, well, you've got two mistakes there. First of all, it's a woman. And second, Lyndall Roper. And secondly, she's from Australia. But she came to Britain because we're in the European Union.
Right. Now, you mentioned Dominic Cummings there. And do you get a sense that he and Johnson are, particularly say with the approach they're taking to the BBC, there's a hostility there. They're banning people from going on things like the Today Show. There's talk about making the licence fee a voluntary contribution. Are they, in your view, deliberately trying to dismantle institutions effectively to stop them holding the government to account?
That's the fear. I think it's a government which isn't burdened by any sense of scruple. And I think wherever they see anything which appears to be making the discharge of executive authority more problematic, they take it on. So they've been critical of the judges, enemies of the people, of our court, of our independent courts, of the BBC, of civic organisations, civil society organisations, particularly those that represent lobbies that may say things they don't like the CBI. So whenever they see any opposition like that, they say that it's an opposition to democracy. It's the crudest sort of majoritarianism.
And what about civil servants, Chris Patton? I mean, surely there's such a tradition there of independence that there would be people who would be in a position to stand up to that.
I can't remember a time when there have been so many leaks attacking civil servants. Civil servants are supposed to be, of course, serving a government and doing what a government wants them to do with a majority in Parliament, but also they're there to point out the dangers or difficulties of any course of action. And if you do that, it shouldn't result in you being guillotined. I can't remember a time when there was as a poisonous an atmosphere in the public sector, and I think that's extremely unhelpful. There's a great British historian called Peter Hennessy who says that we don't have a written constitution, but we rely a great deal on what he calls, or what a civil servant friend of his called, the good chaps, or I suppose good chapesses' idea of government, that there are lines you know you can't cross. There are things you know that you shouldn't consider doing, and you don't need or shouldn't need to go to a very expensive school to know that.
Speaking of good chapesses, I mean, you served and had some robust engagements and encounters with Mrs. Thatcher when she was Prime Minister and leader of the party. Is Johnson not just another conviction politician as she was?
No, he's not a conviction politician. She was. She had a coherent, you might not have agreed with it all the time, but she had a coherent view of how to run the economy. She had a coherent view about Britain's relationship with the rest of the world. She wasn't easy, but she was passionate and principled. And on the whole, I think history will find favourably about Margaret Thatcher. But I don't think this government is principled. I think it operates on a rather different set of indicators. I think it simply wants to be there in order to be there, in order to be there, in order to be there. It's like Kilroy.
From your time, I think, as a junior minister, what, 3.5 decades ago in Northern Ireland, you've retained an interest and more than an interest, participation in events which have brought us to where we are in Northern Ireland. Now we see the power-sharing executive restored. How concerned are you that the removal of Julian Smith and his replacement by a hardliner who doesn't appear to care too much for the I won't even call them the niceties, what was put in place in regard to no hard border here. Do you think that could be more than disruptive, maybe to the point where it could jeopardise the whole process?
Well, every time I think to myself, or every time my wife reminds me that there are times in life where you simply have to accept that the die is cast and move on and not spend too much time obsessive about an issue. And I don't want to spend my time obsessing about the inadequacies of the British government. But every time that I start to feel like that, something happens which makes me think that I do have to speak out. I wish the new Secretary of State for Northern Ireland well. But Julian Smith was probably the most successful in terms of achievement, the most successful minister in the government, not only because of getting the power-sharing executive going again, but actually understanding the issues facing Northern Ireland, given the decisions on Brexit. And he's clearly suffering from having told the truth to the cabinet and to Mr. Johnson, and that's insufferable.
You would have observed as well the way Sinn Féin has come right to the heart of things from the time where you wouldn't have been allowed to talk with them or negotiate with them. They were kept off the airwaves in this jurisdiction and indeed in the UK as well. Now, to quote their current president, Mary Lou MacDonald, the barbarians are through the gate in this jurisdiction here. Have you any observations, you know, as somebody who, as I say, pays close attention to the attitude of the other Irish parties? They want to exclude them in this state from government.
For the last 3 years, I've observed with some admiration politicians from Ireland doing interviews in Britain about the tumultuous state of our politics and doing so with huge diplomatic resource and not actually putting the boot in when they'd have been entirely entitled to do so. And I think I should observe those same
niceties. But you're retired now. You're in the House of Lords.
No. Well, the House of Lords, as you know, is proof of the existence of life after death. But even from the other side, I don't think I should say
you're not going to go there now.
I'm not. I just think...
Hypocrisy, though, not in what you're saying, but in what, and there's a double standard. We want them in government in Belfast, but not in Dublin.
Well, that is that's one of the other reasons why I'm not saying anything about it. But I just say this, that I think it's very important, and it's a point I made last night after this lecture I was giving in St. Anne's Church. I think it's very important to know what happened in the past in order to make an informed judgment about what one should do now. And I hope that everybody who makes any decisions involving Sinn Féin or republicanism will, for example, before doing so, read that remarkable book, Say Nothing, which came out written by an American last year about the
No wonder they
euphemistically called troubles.
The last governor of Hong Kong, which brings me to my last question. It's from a listener. What does Mr. Patton think of what's happening in Hong Kong? How does he see it ending?
I hope it will end with Beijing understanding that you can't lock up people's thoughts, you can't lock up their aspirations and their ambitions, that you can't replace politics by tear gas and rubber and plastic baton rounds and pepper spray. I hope they'll recognise the importance of allowing the government in Hong Kong to establish a public inquiry into the way the demonstrations have been handled and some of the violence which has gone on the part of the demonstrators, which is unpardonable, if understandable sometimes, because there's been nobody for them to talk to. I hope that they will recognise that one country, two systems means exactly that, that it doesn't mean one country, one and a bit systems or one country, one system. I hope they'll recognise that even though Hong Kong reflects most of the or many of the things about government and society which Chinese communists hate, like free speech, like freedom of religion, like freedom of
That's what you hope, but what do you fear, or what do you think will happen?
Well, I'm going to go on with that's one small fragile word hope. Certainly, the way in which Marxist-Leninist authoritarian regimes work isn't, in my view, going to give them an indefinite lifespan. I don't think you can go on treating people as the Chinese Communist Party has been treating, for example, the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, Christian churches all over China. I don't think you can go on treating people like that while technology, the economy and other things change and get away with it. So the attempts to create a surveillance state using AI and technology, I don't think are a proof against ideas which remain eternally relevant to the way people can live their lives in the happiest way.
Chris Patton, thank you so much indeed for coming to studio.
Thank you.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.